This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.
Welcome to Tech News Briefing. It's Monday, April 15th. I'm Julie Chang for The Wall Street Journal. Coming up on today's show, the race is on to build new chip-making facilities. We'll find out why one Brooklyn-based startup is betting on smaller, modular chip plants that are designed to be shipped anywhere, from WSJ reporter Bell Lin. Then, powerful artificial intelligence systems require huge amounts of data. But some say the need for high-quality text data could exceed the supply within 2 years. WSJ reporter Deepa Sitharaman tells us how AI companies are preparing for the potential data shortage. But first, fabrication plants, or fabs, are massive facilities that manufacture chips. They require years to build, billions of dollars, and up to hundreds or more acres of land. Now, one Brooklyn-based startup called Nanotronics says it can make chip plants faster and in virtually any location through what it calls a CubeFab, a modular chip manufacturing facility. These plants could help alleviate some of the global chip demand pressure facing the industry. WSJ reporter Bell Lin visited Nanotronics' Brooklyn headquarters and is with me now. Bell, tell us about Nanotronics' CubeFab.
A CubeFab is really what it sounds like. It's a chip fabrication facility that's in the shape of a cube. And these modular fabrication plants are meant to sit on a really small footprint of land. So it could be anywhere from 2 acres to about 10 acres. And they are meant to be able to produce these kinds of specific power chips all within these pretty small prefabricated facilities, which means that they can be shipped and flat packed onto trucks or onto shipping containers pretty much anywhere throughout the world.
What kinds of chips will Nanotronics be making, and are they different from the ones that TSMC or NVIDIA make?
The chips that Nanotronics plans to be making, and they don't have a customer up and running quite yet. They expect to have their first customer in the Middle East next year. These chips will be a compound of gallium oxide and silicon carbide, among other materials. They're simpler, cheaper, but they're also in just as much, if not more, demand than GPUs and microprocessors and CPUs. And they're mostly for things like power switches and power inverters. So power switches are for things like moving electricity through a data center, and power inverters are for applications like EVs. And they're pretty different from what you'd see from a TSMC or a Micron or GlobalFoundries, because those are really massive fabs that are producing silicon-based microprocessors and things like GPUs for companies like NVIDIA.
What are some of the pros and cons to these smaller modular chip manufacturing facilities?
Well, to start, this is a pretty revolutionary idea in the sense that most fabrication plants and chip fabs today, they're multi-year, sometimes decades-long investments that end up bringing a lot of that chip capacity to U.S. borders. But at the same time, there's a lot of kind of trade-offs in the sense that for every year that you're spending building a chip fab, that's a year or even a month, a week, a day, where you're not actually putting those really expensive equipment and facilities to use. And so the benefit of a chip fab is that you can do all of those kind of building and labor work in a pretty short amount of time, in about a year, and have everything assembled and packaged on site. The downside is that it's a pretty small and really specific facility. But what Nanotronics talks about is one of their primary benefits is that they're trying to close the loop in the supply chain. So if you're an EV manufacturer and you have a CubeFab on your manufacturing site, then you don't need to go elsewhere. You don't need to go to a TSMC to get an important power inverter for your EVs.
How does artificial intelligence fit into Nanotronics' CubeFab operations?
So it fits in a couple different ways, but primarily one of the things that Nanotronics has spent a lot of time doing is building the AI software that comes bundled inside of these CubeFabs. And the AI is meant to replicate the process engineering that humans really did before. So that's looking at the wafers, making sure that it's defect free. And that's something that AI can now do because of the training that Nanotronics has done. And so one of the big selling points is that when Nanotronics first delivers its materials to a customer, it provides initial training to a number of workers. And those need to be people just with some amount of factory experience.
That was Journal reporter Bell Lin. Coming up, could the internet be too small to meet the growing demands of the AI boom? That's after the break.
So, how do we get AI right?
Well, we need the right volume of data, the software to train it, and massive compute power, or...
Another one bites the dust. Are you ready?
Hey, are you ready for this?
Are you hanging on the edge of your seat?
But with HPE GreenLake, we get access to supercomputing to power AI at the scale we need, helping generate better insights.
All right!
Nice teamwork, guys.
Search HPE GreenLake.
AI companies need a lot of data to train their models. OpenAI doesn't disclose details of the training material for GPT-4, its current most advanced language model. But one researcher estimated that it was trained on as many as 12 trillion tokens, which are words or parts of words that the models use. And more powerful systems will require even more data. But now, some executives and researchers say AI companies are facing a data shortage. So how will the next generation of AI models be trained? WSJ reporter Deepa Seetharaman spoke with our colleague Alex Osola about how AI firms are dealing with the problem. Here's our conversation.
Deepa, what kind of data do engineers need to train AI models?
They need high-quality data, writing that's at a professional level, that's conversational and interesting. So scientific research papers, books, newspaper articles, the idea being that this is going to be accurate information that is also reflective of the way humans speak. It's just a huge amount of data that they need to function.
Why is this data potentially getting harder to find?
The problem is that a lot of internet data is nonsense. And it's stuff that not only isn't high quality, but is so bad it could impair the model itself. And what you're left with is a really tiny sliver of the internet being actually useful for these large AI systems.
What's at stake if there isn't more high quality data to train these AI models?
So far, the only way any of these AI companies have found significant, meaningful gains in the performance of these systems is through more data. And we are starting to reach the point at which there isn't enough data to feed the next generation of these systems that would ensure that they would get better. We all think about these systems as they're really good and they're only going to get better. But this problem, if it's not solved, has the potential to arrest that development, really slow it down at a minimum, and maybe take much longer for some of the gains that from AI to actually be realized.
Organizations like social media platforms and news publishers have started pushing back against AI companies using their data for free. How does that fit into this data drought problem?
Well, nobody wants to pay for data. None of these tech companies, none of the companies that are actually building these models, they will pay for some data, but if it's available on the open web, they traditionally have seen that as fair game. So based on talking to a few of our sources, we've learned that OpenAI is, as they're confronting this issue, one of their strategies is to look at YouTube and transcribe all the public high-quality videos, transcribe it into words, and feed that into the model for potentially their next generation model, which would be GPT-5. And they're also looking at data partnerships. One of the things that's interesting about the internet is, as much as there's so much data, there is actually quite a bit of it that isn't public. And so you, as a tech company, are trying to create a relationship with the owners of that data and try to get them to allow you to use it.
One of the things you mentioned as a possible alternative data source is something called synthetic data. Can you tell me what that is and how these companies want to use it?
Synthetic data is basically AI generated data. It's stuff that you make in-house to help you and your model get a little bit closer to what you need. But it carries enormous risks, especially when it comes to large language models like the model that powers ChatGPT. And the best way to describe the risks of synthetic data is to think about it as basically the scientific equivalent of inbreeding. It can confuse the model because the model is supposed to copy human expression. And when it starts to consume computer-generated content, it starts to have difficulty getting better and distinguishing between computer-written writing and human-written writing. And so you start to get a bunch of these problems and the models stop working.
How are tech companies adapting AI models to take this new data constraint into account?
There is this other theory that is emerging and really gaining traction, which is that maybe you don't actually need tons of data at all. And now we need to think about marrying the best data and the best curation models with smart ways of constructing these models. And then that gets you big gains. That is a big scientific question, too. This approach, there are a lot of unanswered questions, like what is the right kind of data? And is there an appropriate order in which to feed information to these models so that it can improve? But there are enough people who believe that an alternative approach is possible that you are starting to see a lot of money flow in this direction. And one of the companies that we talked about in our story is called Datology. It's a bunch of former Meta engineers and has the backing of people like Jeffrey Hinton, Jan LeCun, and other AI luminaries.
That was our reporter Deepa Seetharaman speaking with Alex Osola. And that's it for Tech News Briefing. Today's show was produced by me with supervising producer Catherine Millsop. I'm Julie Chang for The Wall Street Journal. We'll be back this afternoon with TNB Tech Minute. Thanks for listening.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.